another edition of The Cusp Show, the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Joe Favorito, along with my co-host Tom Richardson. Welcome, Tom.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Great. Today we're going to talk, go a little bit off topic, really not the exact business of sports, but we're going to talk about the business of media and a little bit of entrepreneurship. Our guest is Tina Servacio. Tina, for people who are listening, especially in the New York area and nationally as well, even in the D.C. area and in Boston, has been in this business for several years on air, currently right now doing a lot of soccer things, One World Sports, MSG Network, the Red Bulls, a long time with the Knicks on MSG Network, and has really touched on a lot of places, Sirius NBA Radio. So, Tina, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe and Tom, for having me.
Great to have you, Tina.
So how did you get here? I mean, that's really kind of the question. Like, when we were walking in, you talked about having, you know, six different companies that you work with right now. So why don't you tell everybody a little bit about how you kind of got to where you are on air and even off air?
From a little girl, my dad, first of all, and it's interesting because we're doing this podcast on the campus of Columbia University, my dad played for Cornell. So I know a lot about Ivy League college football.
Which sport?
Football.
Okay.
We would, from when I was 3 years old, I have memories of going back to Cornell, coming here to Columbia, going to Princeton to watch Cornell football.
Wow.
And that's where it started, as well as Friday nights, my dad's best friend. And on Friday nights, we would go to his high school football games, Belleville, New Jersey. So it was Friday Night Lights in New Jersey, which was big, almost as big back in the day as what Texas Friday Night Lights is now. It's different now in New Jersey high schools, but it was huge on Friday nights, packed stadiums for high school football. And Saturdays, we would find wherever Cornell was playing closest and go to a Cornell game. So I just grew up going to sporting events. My mother's cousins were all coaches, whether it was crew, softball, wrestling, all high school sports. One cousin does, and he continues to be the head coach at Caldwell College, Mark Carino, is also the athletic director there. So everyone was involved in education and coaching. And really, as I got older, Saturday afternoons morphed into watching any college football game and became a huge Giants football fan, along with my grandparents. I really connected with my grandparents as Giants football and Yankees fans. So it created conversation, watching games with them and building relationships with them in an Italian family. So a little bit of family tradition sort of got my love and interest in passion for sports. That's kind of how that all started.
And what about us in terms of participation? Did you play sports?
Tom, I tried them all.
Okay.
Tried them all. My best sports were gymnastics, cheerleading, track and field.
Okay.
So by the time I got to high school, that's where I excelled and got my varsity letters. But I tried softball and basketball and volleyball and tennis, swimming, diving. I wanted to be an Olympian. My favorite athlete growing up, many people my generation, it was maybe Michael Jordan or Willie Randolph or Reggie Jackson, and you hear about who their favorite athletes were. Mine was Nadia Comaneci.
Wow.
Gymnastics. And then Mary Lou Retton, and would watch them and thought that I was going to be the all-around champion. But when you're 5'6", at like 10 years old, I never grew again. Then that's why I started taking up volleyball and basketball. Then I never grew again. But I enjoyed those sports. And running, I still do today. Running marathons when I can, any kind of 10K race here and there. So I try to keep myself a pseudo-athlete so that there is some kind of common ground when I do interview athletes and we're talking about injuries or injury time or rest or recovery. I can actually have a conversation with them about that.
So when did you first get in front of a camera then to actually start commentating?
I was interviewed in high school by one of our rival high schools. There was a great program, and I forget what it was called, but Clifton High School was right next to Nutley High School, neighboring towns. And it was before our football game one Saturday. It was a Friday afternoon. And what the Clifton High School team did is they invited some of the football players. It was the senior football players and senior cheerleaders. We all went over to Clifton, met with their senior football players and senior cheerleaders. And they had a TV program. My high school did not. I took public speaking, but we didn't have a TV program. And one of the cheerleaders interviewed me about my role as captain of the cheerleaders and the football team. And I was like, wait a minute. I want to do what she's doing. I want to interview, because my view of television at that time was really Barbara Walters, Diane Sawyer. There weren't a ton of women, or I wasn't aware of it yet.
Right.
And then when I got to college, that is when I would go into the dorm common area and watch SportsCenter for hours with a lot of the athletes that were on my floor, women's soccer, women's basketball. women's track and field, lacrosse. They were my friends in college, and we would watch Linda Cohn, and we would see her anchor Sports Center. And I found out she was from the New York area, and she was a Rangers fan. And then that was it. That was the path I was heading to. I wanted to be a sports broadcaster.
And you were at the University of Maryland at that point, and involved in the soccer program in some way, shape, or form, correct?
Yes. So my roommates, or all my hallmates, were on the women's soccer team, and they knew I was interested in sports. I was debating, do I rush for a sorority? What do I? Because that's what my dad actually did. And loved going to football games and basketball games with them, with the women from the soccer team or lacrosse team. They were my friends, hung out with them. We'd go to sporting events. And I started working at the campus radio station immediately when I got on campus. And one of the women's soccer players said, you should be our manager. We had a student manager that had graduated after my freshman year. So second semester, I went in and interviewed the head coach, who was April Heinrichs at the time. She was the eventual U.S. women's national team coach. Her assistant coach was a woman by the name of Jill Ellis.
Wow.
Who is now the current U.S. Women's National Team coach, coming off their World Cup championship. So I worked for April and Jill Ellis, both in their office, everything from setting up their summer camps, taking phone calls, doing their budget for summer camps, to monitoring players' progress in skills and fitness. I would go in early in August, do double sessions with the women's soccer team. We would weigh the players before practice, monitor their water intake, weigh them after. I traveled with them all over the ACC at the time. Mm-hmm. Maryland was in the ACC. So while I didn't compete at a Division I collegiate level, obviously in sports, I really lived the life as a college athlete. My best friends were college athletes, so I saw what it took to be that and become great.
And then you leave, you graduate, you've done all the internships, you've worked at television stations, and then your first big break really kind of that got you into the career in broadcasting was where?
I would say it was arena football. So immediately after college, the thing about graduating with a journalism degree, it looks great, and I graduated with honors, you don't walk out of college and come off the campus with your diploma and you're a sports broadcaster.
Right.
Doesn't happen like that. My first job, I was at a local newspaper. So for about 4 months, I wrote for a local newspaper covering local high school, some small college sports. After that, I took a teaching job because it was available.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to pay bills and become an adult at 22 years old.
And you're back in New Jersey?
In New Jersey. Okay. And I took a teaching job teaching history of radio and journalism. And it was a high school program similar to the one that had inspired me. Great television program. They were building the television studio at the time. So the first semester, I was teaching more about the history of radio and broadcast. So it wasn't so much sports broadcasting. And then 4 months into that, before the studio opens and in semester break, I finally get a production job. So they did release me, and I give many thanks. It was Brick Memorial High School at the time in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
They released me because they saw that I had a dream, and my dream was to work in sports television. And I got a job as a production assistant at New Sport.
Wow.
This is an old station, yes. And it was actually, and there isn't that 24-hour sports center anymore. Because it eventually morphed into what was CNNSI,
mm-hmm.
and then became ESPN News, where it was half-hour sports centers, 24 hours a day. And I commuted 40...
Chet Kopick was one of the original hosts.
Yes, one of the... A legend.
Yep.
So I would commute 40 miles one way to Long Island, because I wasn't making a lot of money. I was living with mom and dad.
So this is the late 90s? When are we...
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Okay. Yes. So this was... My new sport job was 96. I got at the end of 96, so 97 I was there.
So the internet was pretty new.
It was pretty, exactly. So that was pretty
new. CNNSI was just getting established.
Yes, exactly. And I would do everything from log games, and that's what I did as an intern, but at least now I was getting paid for it. Worked my way up into highlight coordinator, where I was picking the highlights. Then I became a writer, where then I selected the highlights and wrote the script for the anchors. I was there not even a year, and the place closed down because CNNSI started up. And all of the producers went there. All the advertising went there. So we had a closed down shop. I was there from December to August.
And you were cutting clips, I assume, the old-fashioned way, right?
It was deck to deck.
Exactly.
It was deck to deck.
Right.
And running the tapes.
Right.
And I would run the tape to the tape deck operator and run the script to the anchor. I learned more, and I hate to say this, get your degrees. Hey, I want to go back for my advanced degree, but I learned more in those months learning how to write for broadcast, because then it was, well, what does the talent want? How do you highlight something? How do you set something up? The notes that the talent wanted so that they would sound natural, that they would sound like they watched the 2.5 hour game when they gave you that 1 minute clip of those highlights. Mm-hmm. So it was about preparing and producing a highlight clip or a story for this anchor. And now I do that every day, because what's changed in sports now, 20 years later, is that I produce and cut and write all of my own work when I work at Channel 5, Fox 5 in New York as a sports anchor. So I don't have a highlight editor or a production assistant. I have to get the clips from the game, write it, choose the clips, go to the editor, have them put them together, use a cutaway here of the reaction shot of the player coming back from his dunk or a coach's shot. So I have to go through all of that, which I learned 20 years ago, but now I'm doing it and I do it fast and do it and get my 3 minute sportscast out at Fox 5.
Tina, I'm really curious to know what percentage of the speaking that an anchor, let's say an ESPN Sports Center like Linda Cohn, mm-hmm. or Kevin Nagandi or Jamie Sire, what percentage are they reading? Do they improv at all? You get the sense that for the good ones, that they're kind of so comfortable, natural, talking
yes.
about a complicated sports topic. So tell me how...
Especially late night, they're probably improvising 89%.
Really? Okay.
It's put into the teleprompter, because a lot of that is happening live.
Right.
So you're just like a morning news show. You're on the desk, so you can't be writing and sifting through sound bites. So by being prepared ahead of time, knowing which games you're covering that night, knowing all the previous stories, all the side stories, which players would be interviewed, which sound bites you might be getting either out of that game, you're aware of all of that. So even if you don't like, say, what somebody wrote in the teleprompter, you can ad lib into the sound bite or over the highlights.
Okay.
So a lot of that, even if it's written on the fly, that is then internally re-edited
right.
and ad libbed. And that's the beauty and what's terrifying about live TV
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
As
and
well.
Are they encouraged, or were you encouraged, or are you encouraged? I know you still do it, to add a little bit of personality.
Absolutely.
On top of what's written for you?
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because it is entertainment.
Right.
And I think sometimes in sports we forget about that too.
Yep.
It's all about LeBron and him not following the Cavaliers anymore on Twitter and all the
right.
negative stuff that Carmelo's saying about Phil Jackson. And all of this happens, you forget it's entertainment.
So just kind of some of the other things we would love to hit on. You touched on arena football and how you got to arena football, and then kind of the way you worked your way into Boston and the Red Sox, and obviously eventually coming to New York on air with MSG, with the Knicks and the Liberty, and tying back to your passion of soccer as well, because you really have
yes,
kind of carved a niche with
target.
The Red Bulls and everywhere else, and the Olympics along the way as well. So
the way I got my really big TV break was with arena football. So it was, again, this is just after New Sport kind of shut down, and I was doing some other jobs at Sports Channel and local cable stations, whatever would pay. There was Staten Island Cable. I did camera. I did graphics. I wrote for news. I anchored news. I did play-by-play for high school and college basketball. I sideline reported for high school and college football. So I did everything at Staten Island Cable. And at the same time, I was doing radio for the New Jersey Red Dogs, which was the local arena football team at the time, and I wasn't getting paid. My parents wanted to kill me. I was living at home. I had three jobs. I wasn't making a lot of money. They're like, you need to find a job. I'm like, well, I'm trying to, and how come you can't get that job, and why is that person on that channel? And it's just, I could never explain it to them to this day. They don't understand why I don't have that job or make this amount of money. But that wasn't getting paid, but by doing the radio broadcasts for arena football.
So who was your partner, by the way, at that point?
Joe Nolan, who is a very well-known, yep. longtime New York traffic
yep.
reporter,
that's
announcer, and anchor, and met him at a job fair. It was a Nets job fair that I went to. I did anything I can to network and meet people. So the New Jersey Nets, I'll never forget, because they were playing the Seattle Supersonics.
Mm.
And talk about two teams that don't yep. exist anymore. And I loved Gary Payton, and I wanted to see him play. Oh, there's a job fair. Went by myself, drove up to the Continental Airlines Arena, and that's where I met Joe Nolan and started doing Red Bulls. But by doing the radio, that led to the TV opportunity. It was CN8 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Comcast Network 8 had an affiliate office in Union, New Jersey. They're based in Philadelphia. It is now the Philadelphia Comcast Channel, station, sports. And I was able to be the sideline reporter because I had that experience from the radio. So that was my first regular TV gig doing sideline reporting for arena football. And then between them and Staten Island Cable, I built the tape. Now, in college, I was always told, all the speakers that came in, you're going to have to go to a small market, make zero money. The zero money was true. You could barely afford slices of cheese. Thank God I was working by where my parents lived because I could live with them. And they would all, and especially because I lived in New Jersey, a few miles from New York City. Oh, you'll never work in New York City. That's the number one market. You'll have to apply to Pocatello, Idaho, and Yakima, Washington, and Peoria, Illinois. So I applied to those places when there was openings. I forget the town in Georgia that I applied to, the affiliate. It wasn't Atlanta. And I did get an interview, and eventually they just said, oh, she's too New York.
Wow.
So I was too New York. And then I thought, you know what?
They literally told you that.
Told me I was too New York. And I thought, but that's a compliment to someone from New Jersey who wants to work in New York, the Big Apple, the capital of the world, the largest city in the world. And that's, I would watch Len Berman on New York TV, right. And I wanted to do what he did.
Sure. Legend.
I wanted to be on New York TV. So that was a compliment to me. And that was the irony, because that's when I started working at Staten Island Cable. Staten Island served more people on that borough, yeah, than most of these cities that I was applying,
right,
to.
Right.
So between those tapes, where was my first really big job? CBS2 New York. I passed up 294 markets, but I had so much work in arena football on CNA, because then I did high school shows. I covered the Jets and Giants every so often for them. Staten Island Cable, that was enough to get the audition, and then I got the job.
And people knew who you were because you were around and
you
had met people.
And I would introduce myself at Giants. I was petrified at Giants and Jets practices. Mm-hmm. But I would go and I would watch how people worked. And from my internships and from doing my job at New Sport, I knew how things were written and spoken and what anchors liked. They gave me so much advice. Mm-hmm. Chet Kopick and all of the Ed Berliner, all of the anchors that I worked with then when I was 21 years old, just out of college. And I took notes and I did practice stand-ups with them and their producers. And I did fake, and I would watch myself then on TV. And don't do this with your hands, and don't say this. And I used to, if you think I talk fast now, you should have heard me when I was 22.
Were there any specific mentors who were like go-to assets for you as you were developing these skills?
Definitely were. And two of them that stand out, and I still keep in touch with Brian Baldinger, who's on NBA, NFL TV.
Went to my high school in Long Island,
oh,
I might add.
Oh, there you go. So
yeah.
Brian,
we graduated the same year, actually.
So here's why he was a mentor to me, because I what I do is I would find someone and follow that, like, what are they doing? So what was interesting about Brian, former NFL player, he was observing Matt Millen and who was his broadcast partner at the time? Oh, Dick Stockton. He was observing them as NFL announcers.
In Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia or New York, wherever they were.
So the side note to this is, the first person who ever gave Brian Baldinger a credential was me when I was the head of PR.
Seriously?
At the Sixers.
Wow.
At WIP.
There you go.
So anyways.
So he's observing them. Yep. And I'm a runner. I'm making $50 to be at a Giants or Eagles game to get them water, to get them whatever they needed. So I was taking any job I can. In fact, at that time, I was even doing updates on WFAN radio overnight. I'd be done at 6 in the morning, and I would either go to Giants Stadium or Yankee Stadium, depending on the season, to be a runner for Fox for $50. And they couldn't believe I was, some people thought, well, who's this girl that wants to be a sportscaster? I'm like, oh, no, I am. I was on FAN all night doing updates. Well, why are you here? Because I want to see how a live game broadcast is produced and what your talent does, whether it's in the booth or the sideline reporters, of course. So I was constantly just being around sports, and I befriend Brian, we befriended each other, and the same thing, observe, learn, network. I learned that from Brian. Always was a sounding board. And then I got to work with Spencer Tillman a little bit later on. And that was at before NFL TV network existed. There was this dedicated Sunday DirecTV channel, and they had a show. They eventually created a show that wrapped around all of those NFL games, and I filled in once in a while. That's where I met Spencer. And he was just such a, it wasn't even so much about sports broadcasting or information about being an NFL announcer with him. It was about being positive and how to treat other people. And there's going to be really tough experiences. And to this day, things that Spencer Tillman told me back years ago when I was working alongside him, filling in here and there, they apply. Those are some things that stick, that don't evolve. They change. They last the duration.
And then your time in Boston with the Red Sox, in New York, you get here, and, you know, kind of an interesting time at MSG with the Knicks, in not the greatest of years, but always intriguing. And you had to come, but you had to kind of carve your own niche as to what you were going to cover and how that all works. So what was that like, Boston, New York, major market?
Yes. So from CBS2, I went to the Boston Red Sox, worked at Nesson as the Red Sox reporter, got to cover World Series. I mean, it was just a fascinating experience that I will never forget, whether it was covering a no-hitter by Clay Buchholz on call-up day. The guy was called up and threw a no-hitter against the Orioles. Or it was covering the Daisuke Matsuzaka flight from Japan to come and sign with the Boston Red Sox. That worked out well. But it was just so many great experiences there. And then, but I just, every day I worked in Boston, I wanted to get back to New York at some point. So MSG had an opening. I got the job. At the time, it was anchoring a sports show, which I wanted to do. I wanted to get into anchoring and hosting. The stock market had just crashed right as I got the job. And 1 year later, all of the sponsors that had signed their five-year contracts, their contracts were up. They were done giving money. You know, Chevrolet, all the big names, Visa, all those big names that sponsored our show, they were done because they didn't have money to sponsor a regional sports show. And because of my experience on the Red Sox, they put me on the Knicks. Knicks never had a regular sideline reporter.
Correct.
They would pull the radio play-by-play to do post-game interviews, or they would pull the fill-in play-by-play announcer. Mike Crispino was filling in, say, for Mike Breen at the time. He would stick around and do the post-game interviews in the locker room. Never traveled anybody. They would just throw headsets on the player after the game, and one of the production assistants would go in the locker room. So I was the first Knicks sideline reporter. That lasted 7 years. There were some fantastic years, like 2012-13, when they won 54 games. Great season, great players, covered legends of the game, future Hall of Famers like Rasheed Wallace and Jason Kidd, developed great relationships with them. And then it was devastating when they were, I grew up a Knicks fan. It was devastating when they were eliminated in Game 6 against the Indiana Pacers. And covered horrible seasons, like the 17-win season, or all I like to say, the 65-loss season. because I withstood it. But you find ways to cover stories. I looked for the positive because that's who I am. So to cover Langston Galloway, the D-League player that really found a niche for himself and started his NBA career, I tried to find the positives in some of those games.
Would you have gotten that job if you weren't as big a Knicks fan? Like, did you need to convince them that you really cared about the team?
So is it okay to go on the record now to say that I was a Yankees fan when I got the Red Sox job?
Okay.
So you didn't.
Now it's fun.
But I told them I was a Mets and Orioles fan. So, hey, you lie about your weight, you lie about who you're a fan of. But I was such a wishy-washy Yankees fan because I learned about baseball and became a baseball fan when the Mets won the 86 World Series. Ron Darling was one of my first favorite professional sports athletes, Daryl Strawberry. So that's what stood out. And then when Doc Gooden was threw a no-hitter when I was in college at Maryland, and they were playing the Orioles, it was fun to see the Yankees. So I was always wishy-washy with my baseball teams anyway.
So we've got a few more minutes.
Can you
tell us about the challenges that modern sports journalists face? Because we all know about what's happened, where writers have become TV commentators, and TV commentators have become tweeters. Everybody's kind of got to play this multi-channel game, it seems like, to keep up. So how are you handling that? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, after 8 years, I had a full-time job between Nesson and MSG Network for 10 solid years, full-time, and which is rare. I've learned that now.
Yeah.
So my contract ended with MSG, as did my time with MSG for a moment, and we'll come back. And what I've learned over almost exactly a year now, coming April, is that, like I said when we started, the games will never go away. So while ancillary programming and full-time jobs seem to be changing and dwindling, I mean, look at Fox Sports 1 canceling so many of their shows that I thought some of them were pretty cool. And I would watch, like, the pregame show because it was setting up all the games that night. They're canceled because, A, money in the economy has changed. And that goes back to that crash in 07 and 08 when I experienced that when my show at MSG was first canceled. And what networks are doing, we see all the cuts at ESPN, all the employees that were let go. Same thing at Fox Sports. So a lot of that, so the full-time jobs are dwindling, and the extra shows are dwindling. Although I think so, there's some great extra ancillary shows that continue on ESPN. But with the games never going away, for the networks to save money, they hire freelancers.
Right.
So now I have 6 freelance jobs. I work at Channel 5. I'm not full-time there. While I'm guaranteed 2 days a week, I'm still a freelancer. Mm-hmm. So some weeks I work 5 to 6 days. Some weeks I work 2 days. NBA Radio, same thing. I'm not even guaranteed a day a week, but some weeks I work 5 days and I host 5 shows. Some weeks it's 1 show. So that's radio, TV. So I'm a local sportscaster. I'm a radio broadcaster for a national network. One World Sports, which is a new type of a network. That's an international network.
That
covers
mm-hmm.
soccer and international sports.
Yep.
So I'm a Cosmos broadcaster of them, pregame, in-game, halftime.
How many pages is your resume?
It's goofy now. Now you just bullet point it.
Okay.
And that's why you have websites and all that craziness. MSG asked me back to do the New York Red Bulls. So I'm pregame host, halftime for them, do in-game reporting, and a magazine show for the Red Bulls as well. Same thing, NASL this week. Big Ten Network during the fall, college football sideline. So at least that's just September to December. But it gets really crazy September, October with soccer still going on. And I feel like, oh, and now I get a call from the Arena Football League just a few weeks ago. We would like to hire you as our sideline reporter. And what's interesting about this, on ESPN and CBS Sports, competing networks, but because the league has hired me, even though my paychecks for ESPN games come from ESPN and my paychecks from CBS Sports Network will come from CBS Sports Network, that's what's different. I'm on 2 different networks, but because it was the league approval, it was the league's choice, just like the New York Red Bulls. They said, we want Tina Servasio as our host, even though she's not under contract anymore at MSG Network. You go get her. So it's changing. Teams, Players Tribune, great example. Teams and players have a lot of influence. The teams and the players and the games will never go away. So now I'm trying to figure out a way to hone in there, where I think TV may go away. ESPN's becoming a pay service. Apple TV, Google TV, I don't even know what it's called. Chrome, whatever that's
Chromecast,
called.
Yeah.
Podcasts. So that, it's evolving. Which way will that direction go? Who knows what'll be even invented next?
Yeah.
But the games and the TV, the athletes, that they won't go away.
And you were an early adopter in social media, and that's kind of where I think
mm-hmm.
we should wrap it up. So
great.
You've got a great following on Twitter, on Instagram, and because it's yours,
mm-hmm.
you can bring that to wherever you go. You don't have to worry about being so-and-so from ESPN. You've
right.
built your own brand. And that's why I think it translates across, you know, everything you did from production, beginning with the Arena Football League in college,
mm-hmm.
all the way to today. I mean, so, but you own your brand.
I mix up my social media because I think I don't want to be Tina Servasio, the female sports broadcaster.
Right.
You know, Tina Servasio, who loves sports and does television, sort of the, I don't know what my brand is. Maybe, Joe, you could tell me what it is. We'll figure that out. But I like to show a little bit of my personal side. It's more like my life as a sports broadcaster, how, you know, days I do doubles from NBA radio in the morning to covering the NCAA tournament in the afternoon, but I love it still anyway. I try to be inspiring too. I found that people that are inspiring, I've tried to work that in a little bit too, about being grateful for things. Even, you know, I lost my job at one point. There was one point last year where I had no job and now I have 6. So maybe I can encourage people, even if they don't want to go into sports television, if they're a sports fan and they follow me because they want to hear when we have the Warriors play-by-play announcer on NBA radio, maybe I can connect with them in some sort of way from my experiences.
How are you prioritizing the social networks? Because you're on a few of them.
It's, well, I linked them up. So I really started Twitter. And it's helped me as a broadcaster because I, as we could tell, I could talk and talk. So it helps me be concise. And same thing with Instagram. I think the visual, that's why I got into television, because of the visual. So location shots, behind the scenes shots, I like to show that on Instagram. Right. And then they both feed to my Facebook, which I hardly ever go on Facebook, and I get yelled at by my family and my friends. You didn't answer me. Well, I don't go on Facebook. I just do everything from Twitter.
Right, but for your professional
Instagram.
Brand, you're basically saying that Twitter and Instagram are the key platforms.
For me, that works best for me.
Okay.
That works
Anything
best
on
for
Snapchat
me.
Yet?
I have not done Snapchat okay. yet. Periscope is
getting
close.
Is it on your phone right now? Do you have the
no,
app?
No, but I'm tempted about the Periscope, especially when I do radio.
Yeah.
It creates a visual of the radio then.
Yeah.
So, Tina, how do we find you for people who want to follow you on Twitter especially?
It's easy. At Tina Servasio. Same thing on Instagram. Same thing on Facebook. Just look for my name. Cervasio. It's not bad once you spell it once.
Tina Servasio, thanks for joining us. Once again, I'm Joe Favorito.
And Tom Richardson. Really appreciate it, Tina. It was a great show.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to this episode of The Cusp Show. That's the Columbia University Sports Podcast. I'm Tom Richardson. My co-host is Joe Favorito. And our production assistant this week is Columbia student James Appel. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple's podcast app, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and on other key platforms. You can also see it at blogtalkradio.com/The Cusp Show. And you can get in touch with us on Twitter at CU Sports Biz, that's B-I-Z. Also, you can find out more about our program, the Columbia University Sports Management Program, by going online at sps.columbia.edu/sports-management. Thank you.